Welcome to the Designing Hollywood podcast in association with the John Campia Show. I am your host, Robert Meyer Burnett. This episode is sponsored by the Costumes Rentals Corporation. Today's guest is a classically trained film and theater costume designer who creates fantasy worlds where future humans are forced to face down robots and aliens. From the storyline and characters to the actors and directors, the costume designer embraces every facet of production, and she lets her romance with the production guide her creative spirit. Her journey began in the theater. As a 12-year-old, she was exposed to theater reviews from the Wellington Theater in New Zealand. As a teen, she wanted to learn as much as she could about production, including painting scenery and making props. Quickly mastering her craft, she met Guillermo del Toro when he was initially attached to adapt The Hobbit trilogy. She created concepts, drawings, and samples for characters in all three films. Although she didn't remain attached to the trilogy when Peter Jackson reclaimed the reins for the production, her designs provided a template that is carried through each installment, including The Battle of the Five Armies. From Pacific Rim, she jumped directly to Doug Liman's sci-fi romance thriller, Edge of Tomorrow. I don't know if I'd call it a romance, but that was written for me. For the uniforms in this film, she spent a great deal of time researching technology, as well as World War II photographs, images of the Vietnam War, and 16th century Scottish paintings. The mixture of historic references helped her discover textures and colors that brought a reality to the futuristic storyline and characters. Tom Cruise became an active participant in the creation of the uniform, including the boot designs. She worked with NFL safety padding as well as ski and snow boot designs to create something both futuristic in appearance and fully functional as to not inhibit the actors' performances. And as a side note, Edge of Tomorrow is the most underappreciated sci-fi movie ever made, and it needs a bigger audience. So without further ado, it is my pleasure to welcome costume designer Kate Hawley to the Designing Hollywood Show. Kate, welcome, and thank you for being here.
Oh, thank you very much. It's a pleasure.
Now, I have to say, as a dyed-in-the-wool film geek and a sci-fi fantasy horror fan, your list of credits, you go from Pacific Rim to Edge of Tomorrow to Crimson Peak to Suicide Squad. You did The Mortal Engines, Chaos Walking, and then you're working on, well, you worked on the first season of Lord of the Rings, The Rings of Power, and now you're working on something I won't say what it is, but even that I can't wait to see.
So I know, and I was sort of going, oh, I've got a list of really wonderful, creepy directors I'd love to work with.
Well, that's good to hear. Now, I want to yeah. ask you about...
the dark side.
I want to ask you about growing up in New Zealand. And, you know, for me, I think I started realizing New Zealand had a film industry when I saw Jeff Murphy's U2 and then The Quiet Earth, which is a great science fiction film. What was it like for you growing up in New Zealand and watching the film business there become what it is today?
I think you sort of, there was that period with Jeff Murphy, and then I remember going overseas and studying and, you know, doing a bit of that sort of adventuring and things. And when I came back, you know, the Peter Jackson and The Wonderful World of Weta and everything had sort of created this massive world, and everything had sort of just exponentially changed. And the energies, you know, we've got artists like Jane Campion and many others, all with their own individual voice, which I found incredible in such a small country, the energy and the opportunity to have your own individual voice. And every time I came back home, because I've been nomadic a lot, but I was thrilled at the sort of, there was always an opportunity in returning home and something to be discovered. And I think what I feel looking back at that period is that we, as a country, we sort of looked less overseas to others for inspiration and identified more with ourselves as individuals, as a country. We're so informed about the landscape, and I think you see that very much in the works of Jeff Murphy, Jane Campion, all work, and, you know, Peter's Lord of the Rings. The landscape and the energy of that landscape, you know, there's a darkness to the beauty in this country of ours. There's an amazing spirit and energy in the earth, and I think you find that in the work of the films. That's my response to it, you know.
Now, did you, you know, a lot of the costume designers I've spoken to have a pretty rigorous academic background. Is that true for you?
I don't know if it was rigorous. I used to sort of skive off quite a lot. I had to go and do a graphic design course because my parents, who are very supportive of what I do, but they sort of said, you've got to earn a living. So I remember sort of, you know, airbrushing Mars bars and sort of not being totally dedicated to that idea. And I would run off to the theatre, and I actually jump out of senior school as well to go and work in the opera. But I think I was very lucky in that I had teachers that actually recognised that I'd discovered something that was a passion. And although I got lots of D's when I was growing up and through university, and that, I think there was some tolerance that I actually was making myself useful for a start. And I did do I went to the School of Motley Theatre Design in London. It's sort of a postgraduate course, and I think TV New Zealand at the time had a scholarship achievement award, which I was very lucky to get, because going overseas was no small thing. And I studied for a year with Percy Harris in the last 2 years of her tenureship there, and we had Mike Lee and Stephen Daldry, and we had Jocelyn Herbert, Samuel Beckett's designer, and of course Percy was part of the Motley group, and it was the most unique time. We sat between the 80s and pre that world with Gielgud and Laurence Olivier, and all of that was still just part of that world. In fact, we all went to, as a class, because Percy was there, we all went to Gielgud's funeral. And then on the other hand, we had all these new cool directors coming through, Stephen Daldry, Tim Aubrey, all these people, and Mike Lee, and we had it's an amazing place to sit culturally in between these two generations for that moment. So, I was also passionately involved in the opera, so I feel like there's many different influences. Contemporary dance is such an exciting theatrical place to be, and sometimes what I find is the world of theatre is becoming very cinematic with technologies and things today, and the world of cinema can be often very real, and it's wonderful sometimes. I'm quite schizophrenic in the way I like to approach things. I'll go, I've done that, now I'd like to try approaching things a different way. But you sort of go, when we grew up in the 80s and you saw Derek Jarman and Ken Russell and all these Greenaway doing their work, the film was very theatrical, and it's quite interesting. And when I met Guillermo, for example, he loved that I'd come from a more theatrical background. For once, it wasn't a tick against me, because in this world that we're in, it's very easy in this industry to be compartmentalized. And it's sort of funny, because for a while everyone wanted to offer me sort of exosuit movies, and then I went, darling, it was lovely for a bit, but not every day. But your training, the process I learned at Motley has always stayed with me. And these projects move fast and furious these days. The timelines get shorter, we have to tap dance faster. But the process I was taught for supporting actors in the theatre, a script, supporting the character in a script, those things I keep coming back to in the process. I mean, sometimes if I'm doing a bigger production, you get a whole lot of producers coming in and you're showing them mood boards, and they go, what the fuck's a mood board? And you're going, okay, you get a picture as well. But it's not just about getting to the end result, it's trying to build up all the stakes, the sort of arcs that you want to create, so you have something to hang on to when it becomes total chaos, really.
Well, were you a fan? I mean, I look at your filmography. Were you a fan of sci-fi, fantasy, and horror growing up?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I was brought up on the Brothers Grimm and the Norse myths, but the really gritty ones. We had the heels chopped off and, tongues cut out. I'm that girl, and then, I won't get into, but the original Norse myths are so brutal and visceral and fantastic. And so I grew up in that world. And, Terry Gilliam, Brazil, all those sorts of movies, Blade Runner, and David Lynch's Dune was for me one of those moments where I went, I'd love to be a costume designer. Bob Ringwood was an amazing artist. I lived near him in Suffolk for a while, so he sort of became my little mentor for a while, and he's such a talented man. And Jim Acheson, I got to meet in New Zealand, another fantastic, amazing costume designer who did The Last Emperor and Dangerous Liaisons. And those people, that generation, had this amazing process and beautiful approach to work in the storytelling. And I remember getting ticked off by a couple of them a few times about, now this is about supporting this and it's not about that, and learning the value of that and trying to shed your own beliefs in that, all your personal stuff. When you walk into a project, it's not unlike an actor. You have to embrace what's right for the character. And I suppose an example of that is Harley Quinn and Suicide Squad, you know, that I read all the comics, all 52 editions of it, and we wrote all the quotes on the wall of how she expresses herself as a character and how she reflects her relationship with the Joker. And a lot of people felt uncomfortable with the way we interpreted that character, but she has so many iterations. She's, you know, a Harlequin, and her constant changing of motley is almost like a kind of warfare in itself. And it was her, she owned it, and that's the difference. And I, you know, so our job's to not put our own personal values on these things. It's to go, you know, support the character and the actor doing the job.
Well, when you did Suicide Squad, since you brought it up, you got to you got to design not one or two characters, but a whole pantheon of anti-heroes.
Oh, yeah, I love the little ones best, you know, darling. I love those, you know, with the Joker's gang, and was it a panda in the end? We had a little panda softy suit, and I love all those little characters you can have a lot of fun with.
Well, also, I mean, I thought the Joker's costumes in that film were incredible. I mean...
Yeah, well, we went through quite a lot. Almost as many as Harley to get there, but that's part of the process. You know, it's again part of that supporting. You know, we have our idea of what the character would look like. The director, most importantly, has his. Sometimes the studio has theirs. There's the impact of what's been seen before, and of course, there's always this thing of let's do something different. But then there's also, but in the end, there's still the core values that come through that don't change. There's still the same themes, the same. You can't go and invent anything new. All of those things are still there, but it's the interpretation. Just as an actor will interpret that role, that subtle shift can be something that is either illustrated or not, and that's our job, is to help support that. And, you know, sometimes it's often an actor going, no less, I can do this, you know, I don't need that. And, you know, trying to support that and give up lollies, as we call them, to do that, you know. And there's many aspects that, you know, you're sort of, a psychologist, you know, you read, you have to approach the script in the same way they do. You're an observer of the minute eye of life. And then there's the bigger shapes of things, the bigger arcs of the story that you're telling. And the collaboration is huge. So, you know, the way the DOP wants to approach this, the way the production designer is approaching this, you know, that every element, props, makeup, and it's... one of my lovely experiences of that, working to a really high position, Edge of Tomorrow on one side, but also Crimson Peak, where there was such, Guillermo created the palette and things, and there was such an amazing communication, because it's so hard these days to, you know, keep that up as well as doing the job. You know, everyone wants to run off and do their job, but it was so considerate, and so it was almost like everyone's going, no, you go first.
Crimson Peak is a just unbelievably gorgeous looking film. I mean,
it was a passion project, that one. The chance, I remember watching Pan's Labyrinth and turning to a friend of mine when I was watching this in a little hotel room in Auckland, and I'd just been doing an opera, and I said, gosh, I'd love to work with that director one day. And when that happened and I got to work on Crimson Peak, it was sort of this outpouring, oh, we get to play in loveliness and the dream working with it. You know, it's never, when Gemma says I'm doing a Victorian Gothic thing, and he goes, it's just, you know, it's just Victorian in this period, go and look it up. Get, no, we're not. This is Guillermo. Like, when Guillermo says we're doing Rain, it's not just a little, you know, in Pacific Rim, he decided to do Rain big time. And we were sitting there, and we had all these nuns that of the kaiju. We had this, because he's got beautiful details and all these extra scenes, which you spend hours doing, and they blip across for a few minutes. But he wanted all these nuns with the big flying, headdresses on. And then we discovered he was doing Monsoon, so everything would have just gone like that. So we had to create these, you know, cast them out of the strong plastic to do this. But they acted like, because of the way they're designed, the water hit them, and they acted like a drain off a house, you know, if you're guttering. So they literally poured water off them. So anyway, it's knowing the director you're working with.
Well, you know, you work with Guillermo on his version of The Hobbit that obviously changed, yeah. But then you did two films with him. You did Crimson Peak, but before that you did Pacific Rim. And what I find interesting is that you went from Pacific Rim to Edge of Tomorrow, where you had to design two sets of futuristic military. How did you begin?
It was aging.
I mean, it's so interesting to me that when you're designing, because it wasn't just like one military dude, or a woman, you had to design an entire military, because there's a lot of extras.
Nations of the world.
How does that start? How did that begin for you?
I'll tell you what's interesting. When you're doing these things, if you're doing something like Crimson Peak and you're in the world of costume, nobody wants to know, you know, that all the boys do their own thing. When you're doing robot movie or, you know, an exosuit, everyone wants to get in there. So it's quite, but it's all about collaboration. You know, every department was involved in creating those things. And Pierre Bohana, who was the, you know, the master propsman, you know, developing the parts for the suit, he's a gentleman and he was a wonderful, he's just a genius. And, you know, it was sort of like blind baking. And there was over, I think I've got a map of one of those exosuits still, there's over 500 working parts. And and I remember doing a fitting, I'm not sure if this is a bit naughty, but I remember doing a fitting where we'd mocked up one side in sort of, you know, rough kind of 3D print, and then we'd done the other side in cardboard, just to give Doug and Tom an idea of it. And I remember Doug coming in, he goes, I really love this side, but I don't love that side.
And it was the cardboard side you loved, right?
Yeah. It's going to be right on the day. but it's interesting where suddenly, you know, if it's a period show, most people go, oh no, you just carry on.
Well, we got to know what the action figures they're going to look like that we're going to buy later and put on our shelves. So we have to make, that's why everybody has to weigh in.
I realized this because when we were doing Pacific Rim, I think, you know, there were all the Russians and we had the Chinese, we had all these different groups and, you know, all of that was, I mean, the whole team was having so much fun. I mean, it was just about having fun. And then when you saw the scale of it, the operatic scale of it, it's not just watching a big blockbuster on the weekend. It's a beautiful thing. It's theatrical and luscious and, you know, wonderful.
Incredible. Now, yeah. you've worked with both Doug Liman, you've worked with him multiple times, and Guillermo del Toro. How do you develop a relationship, a working relationship with the director? Is it something that you arrive at organically, or what's the secret?
Depends. I don't think I've worked out the secret yet, but it's, I think it's all these things, and actually Guillermo said it to himself to me. You know, it's about chemistry. It's a relationship. So, you know, it's almost like a first date. You know, go, do you like this? Yeah, I like it. Oh, I like that too. You know, when I met Guillermo for the first time, and Peter introduced us. He just came into the office one day, sort of had me down the back of the corridor like Miss Havisham. I was drawing on something, another project. And Guillermo came in and he introduced me. And the first conversation was just about the books that I had and the books that we had in common, you know, Joel Peter Witkin, Goya and all that. And you go, okay, there's a language we understand. Mm. And sometimes you're working with people that you don't know their language, but it's to try and understand, you know, look at what they're interested in, you know, try and listen a bit better, you know, all that, you know, trying to understand how they see it. You know, we can all look at an image. It's fascinating, actually, even with people that you know very well that you've worked with, we're always looking at images together. And, you know, for example, we can all look at a painting. And when I was prepping Crimson Peak, Jessica Chastain and Tom were in town for the TIFF, you know, festival, and they came to look at, I had all these mood boards. We just started developing this with Guillermo, and they were looking at images and that. And it was surprising what came out, what drew them to a certain image. You know, there's one image and Jessica went, that's the face of Lucille, or, you know, how we interpret a colour and things, and it's important. So it's really trying to understand, and often, you know, some directors are less interested in the visual, but it's hearing what they're not saying as well. You know, it's like trying to sort of, it's another secret language of trying to understand, because sometimes these things are a discovery. There's no reference, you know. A lot of times working with these directors, it's not a specific reference, but you learn that they have a certain language. And then, you know, I know Doug likes things, you know, feeling more organic and sort of improvised and found and things like that. So it's a different language that we have with him. And there's certain things that he would find, you know, what one person likes, another won't. So it's learning that, but also trying to offer things beyond that all the time, so that you can keep developing and pushing things along. And that's when it's a lot of fun. And, you know, this process is so fast these days, but when you have a moment just to bish-bosh shit around and, you know, have a, you know, create, just talk about stuff, you know, you suddenly you're actually working. You know, it's, we have this thing, possibly because it's become more of an industry in terms of a business, but you know, it's not about sitting at your desk to prove the work. It's sometimes it's going for a walk or to a museum, and I often try and do that with colleagues, and it's very rare that you can do that these days, but just, you know, we're here in Budapest at the moment and went to the Moore Museum the other day, or, you know, just walking around, and you might notice something as tiny as the surface texture of something or a beautiful monument in that. And those things change the way you look and what you can offer. And I think everyone works, you know, everyone has a different way of working like that, and it's trying to find new openings. We all get stuck on stuff, and you know, sometimes it's hard to understand what a director might be wanting because they haven't found it themselves. It's something, right. It's like a movie. We're all chasing it. So it's trying to help going, is it this? It's offering stuff and listening to their perspective on something.
Well, you did work a little bit on The Hobbit and then it changed. But now we're in the middle of episode 6, aired today, of Lord of the Rings, The Rings of Power.
And what happened?
There was a big battle. And Mordor was born. It was a big episode. It was a big episode with
wondering how it got there.
Humans, orcs, Numenorians. I love the orcs.
Yeah. I'm very fond of orcs.
So it seems like anybody from New Zealand has to get involved in whatever Lord of the Rings project is being made now.
Well, I sucked in some of the old troopers from the first Lord of the Rings.
I was gonna say, I mean, so you actually went back to your homeland. You went to New Zealand. Yeah. The first season was in. How did you get involved in Rings of Power? Did Jeff Bezos call you up and just say, yo, Amazon's making some Lord of the
Rings? No. I'm actually not quite sure, but I think it was one of those things that I think it was a call that came through my agent. It's a while ago now. Time passes. And, you know, and of course, we'd all heard that this was happening. And I think it was a phone call, you know. So then it was about, you know, many, many meetings and, you know, silence for ages and more meetings. And it went on for a long time. So it was sort of like, I probably aged 3,000 years in between all of that. But,
you know, an entire age of Middle Earth.
And none of us really knew any more than anyone else about, you know, what it was going to be about and that. But, you know, I think we're all suckers for the Silmarillion. You know, we've all read that a million times with the energy of those, you know, it's like the Greek gods, the tragedy of that world. And we're very passionate about it. So, of course, we're suckers to go and do it again. and my colleagues are like that too. They can't, you know, they're artists, you know, the armourers, you know, Matt Appleton and Emily Starrick, and we had Daniel Falconer on our team, and we had, you know, people are passionate about the material.
Now, I recognize these names, and of course, we interviewed Nyla back when we were doing the special features for Lord of the Rings. Yeah, amazing. Yeah. But now I have to ask you, obviously you're dealing with the second age of Middle Earth, and obviously you've already brought up the Silmarillion, so you're steeped in the lore and the history. Did you feel... Obviously, the Hobbit movies and the Lord of the Rings movies would loom large. Did you feel pressure to do something original, or was it always sort of, you know, you're because you're kind of leading up to the beginning of Lord of the Rings, which shows the end of the Second Age. It opens with
still got 1,000 years to go.
Yeah,
still got some way to go. Well, it's all the perception of time, and everyone. You know, there's the real time that Tolkien depicts. It's very clear about it. You know, I think Elrond's 6,000 years old in the trilogy. You know, where we're meeting these people and, you know, elves, orcs and dwarves in this place, you know, and many people would argue things wouldn't change at all. But there's definitely a season in this world. And in the Third Age, it is a time of fading and passing. And look, Lord of the Rings is... you know, it's one of the most beautiful things, and the way they depicted the atmosphere of the books, you know, the poetic, you know, tone of the things, you know, Alan Lee's drawings becoming real with the mist and not seeing around the corner, and the atmosphere and poetry of it is so sublime, and that fading of the world and where the trees take the light. And in this part of the world, the trees are, you know, we're at this stage, we're in the trees, give the light, you know, it's a very different a part of the world, and it's wild, and we're in, you know, when I was reading, you know, the Silmarillion and all of this work, you know, you're suddenly aware of there are more dragons around at this time. You know, there's all these, or worms, you know, there's all of this stuff. There's, we had to refer to the first age and the third age. You can't, you know, you can't just study one area. You have to, you know, you suddenly your personal history of someone goes over 6,000 years.
Right.
And then you've got the interpretations of that, you know, sort of someone who hasn't had those sorrows and tragedies yet, you know, they'll have thousands of years to reflect on mistakes and choices made. And, you know, so time is such a huge thing. But the biggest thing is that it was the time of, you know, the third age is the time of man, and the magic and the world of the elves is fading. And in our world, it's at its height, and men haven't, but, you know, apart from, you know, the Numenoreans, but it's a different energy. And we sit between two great wars. We sit between the War of the Cimmerils and the War of the Rings. So you've got many displaced cultures in this world, and there's a, you know, it's almost like the 20s sitting in between World War One and World War Two.
Right.
You know,
that's a great way to put it.
Yeah. And, you know, but I would say all the same, when we were researching in that, you read all the books, it's the same imagery, you know, elves represented by stars and the light of the stars in their eyes, water, born on shores of pearl, you know, Tolkien talks about his heroes covered in the dust of diamonds, and all of these things are describing nature. But, you know, when you haven't necessarily got his words to use, we used his words and in the costume department as a source of inspiration for describing it. And I think we all go through the same. There's the world of Tolkien himself. We went back to all the Germanic cultures and mythologies, as well as the European and English ones, you know, the world of the Green Man. We went to, you know, there's all the works of Edward Burne-Jones and the Pre-Raphaelites. So all of this became part of our consciousness. And, you know, a lot of sort of inspiration for some of the Elven stuff actually came from, it's going to sound a bit nerdy, but Alan has statues in Rivendell with elves from the first age on them. So we did all of this and took those moments. And I think the most beautiful thing about the work and writings personally for me is the figure in the landscape, and how simple some of that, sometimes that silhouette can be, you know, and how beautiful. So personally, you know, and I love the words of Tolkien. To me, they're the most beautiful things.
Well, that, it's good to hear that you know, Tolkien was your, that's where you went to for all of your inspiration. It's good. No, it's, well, it's, and obviously you can tell, you know, your Tolkien, you know, your Professor Tolkien.
Oh yeah, we do. And, you know, you know, there were some things that we knew in the development of this, and other things that we didn't, you know, because it was a very secretive project, you know, so we didn't always know what that character would end up being. But you have to, you know, we're always asking ourselves, well, if this is this, then this must be this. And also, and trying to, you know, you have to understand the relationship between the histories of those things, you know, with, for example, all the helms we made for the orcs are horse heads and things like that, because they rid Middle Earth of horses. So when Galadriel, you know, sees a horse, it's a big moment. And, you know, all these, understanding where you're going to go 1,000 years from now, 3,000 years, you know, who's got what at a time, you know, what is the meaning of this object or personalized thing. And I think what is exceptionally beautiful that you see very strongly in the ruins and artifacts of the third age is that we've got the artifacts and layers of other battles, and, you know, there were artifacts that we created in the costume props. There were scrolls with the head of, you know, Gondolin on it. You know, we were working with Robert Arameo, who plays Elrond, and you know, Elrond is a lover of history, and there's a passion that starts from, you know, years ago in this world. So we added those things. And then when you don't always, you know, it's not like we've got Lord of the Rings, the book, you know, we're dealing with a different, you know, text. And so we're sort of trying to bring all those elements where we can to sort of, you know, put some grounding there for our characters in that. And, you know, one of the things was, instead of swords, when they, you know, are trying, you know, we're in a time of relative peace at this point, they wear scrolls instead of the swords. So it's, a, you know, instead on their hip. So it's trying to find images. And we did this with you know, the dwarves in Khazad Dûm, because there was a lot of, you don't see, there was so much stuff that we created, I think, you know, with, there's a lot of secretiveness and magic in there, and there's elements of the Helm of Hurun, and, you know, we dug up lots of stuff. We're very geeky.
Well, when you're designing, I mean, one of the things that obviously Galadriel's front and center, and her armor is striking. I mean, this is different, very different from what we saw Cate Blanchett wearing thousands of years later in Lord of the Rings. Yeah. What was the design process like? Was it always in the inception process? Was she always wearing armor? Was that armor a thing for her?
That was very firmly written in the script. You know, it was what was there. So, you know, we were working with the script at that point, and you know, that was all discussed. I think one of the things that we really did when we were doing the research, and it's a hard thing, you know, these days you've got stunts and all sorts of things to cater to, a lot of practical things you have to consider, but we literally made all the chainmail for the Northern Wastes. So the chainmail we see Galadriel wear, that was many layers. We actually sort of draped it based off one of Edward Burns' paintings, you know, his King Arthur, and all of that was actually draped. And you don't see it, but there's all this lace work done into the chainmail, and many hundreds of crystals sewn into it. And for me, the moment when she was on top of, when I watched episode one, she was on top of the cliff, just, you know, silhouetted there, felt to me like a moment of where it was an elf and an elven armor with the chainmail, because the chainmail was what Tolkien talked about a lot. And then there's the, you know, there's other practical considerations and schedule and time. So I think we spent 6 months doing that. We had to get a lot faster with everything else. Took many months of handwork and manicures, I think.
And also, one of the things that we didn't see in Lord of the Rings or The Hobbit was Numenor, obviously, because it was gone.
Yes.
It was destroyed.
Yeah.
How did you approach the Numenorean civilization, I guess the call it the height of men or whatever, before the fall? Yeah. Did you have a specific inspirations for what you wanted to do with the Numenoreans?
I think there's, well, everybody in all these cultures, everyone has their the nature of their world and environment reflected. So we talked about the elves and then there's the dwarves and the orcs, and so a lot of the materiality of their costumes and the color and that comes from the elements, nature. In Tolkien's world, so that's always the first point of inspiration. Then there's the gods with the dwarves. It was the Aule, and the fire of Aule in his eyes was something I felt I wanted to see reflected in there, and the colours and the furnaces creating things and the forges and creating that atmosphere there. And with the Numenoreans, there's the god and goddess of the sea and love of horses and that. And I was looking at a lot at, actually had John working with us, but there was beautiful paintings that he and Alan had done. So scale work became part of that. And actually all of that armor was hand sculpted first before it went into production run. Every scale was, I know, and it's sort of some of those things that you did, you know, depending on lighting and that, it sort of changes it. But all of that was hand sculpted. Even the armor on the ship was sort of taken from a reference of Back with the Elves of a Symbolist painting, and it was actually sculpted to reflect pearl. But the Numenorean stuff was, you know, all sort of bone and ivory, that world. And, it was all done by hand, and we had all the gods of the sea. And when Galadriel is on the raft and we first greeted by the Numenoreans, we actually wound Neptune's necklace to reflect the goddess of the sea and that. And so, you know, there was lots of thought that went into it, and, you know, colour is one that, you know, the showrunners, Patrick and JD, wanted a warm, more Mediterranean feel. You know, sometimes an island can be a cold place or a warm place, so the climate, you know, dictated a certain amount of that. And with Muriel and that, there's lots of references to that, and the, you know, then there's the layers of the elven world hidden in between. So there was the guild work, all of these things affected it. You know, it was a big project, but the armor was the biggest one. And we did the barding and everything as well, as the costume department, which was, you know, we had a big team.
Oh, I can only imagine.
Can we make each scale by hand? And they're all looking at me. And nah.
How many copies or doubles, or how many of each costume did you have to make?
Yeah, well, I think with Galadriel's simple white shift with pearls and things that she wears in the water and the raft when she's, you know, crossing the ocean, there was 100 of those. You know, we did many different lengths. We did there were lengths where we had extended ones by meters. So we were doing, we did water tests in the house I was staying in that had a pool. And we got some of my crew dressed in the shifts, the many shifts, because we were trying to create a Lalique. You know, there was one gown that we had so long, it did this beautiful Lalique movement. We were, but, you know, it was an indulgence, you know, it didn't make it. But we're trying. You know, so that's just one aspect. And then, you know, suddenly it leaps from doing one or two units that we did Vanna to suddenly multiple units. And I think there were over 2,000 costumes at the end.
Wow. That's just for the first season.
Yeah, and there was a wee pandemic in the middle of that, and it's not something you can sort of hire or rent.
Sure, no, absolutely.
You know, the classic, there's no home base that sells that, you know. Sort of, but also just, it was quite big, it was a challenge, you know, in that way that there's, you know, quite a lot of cultures. There was a lot happening, a lot of different characters and a lot of cultures in the first series. So trying to give each the depth that each needed and the respect and, you know, seriousness that they needed, you know, was quite a task when you're sort of trying to tap dance through all of it and meet the normal requirements of a shooting schedule. But it was a delight trying to, you know, working with the cast and their input, and often they turned up, you know, some of them didn't know who they were playing until they got to New Zealand. So you're having to support them, and we're all trying to, you know, because we don't, you know, you're trying to work, you know, around the, you know, challenges that you have and offer support and dig as deeply for them, you know, that you can, create. There's gaps in some of the stuff and of the work and trying to fill those in and make sense of it and mostly support the characters and the actors. You know, it's a big thing for them.
Did you have a favorite design from season one, a favorite costume?
Oh, I think you learn to love and hate everyone as you go through the process. Then you love them again at the end. It's like children. I think the orcs and the dwarves were my favourite. It was, you know, I wouldn't have never enjoyed doing an orc before, but we learnt to love them, actually, and sort of we had lots of ideas that we actually got so excited, but they, you know, we didn't get to do all of those things, so some of those things might wait. But, you know, and the dwarves are such great character roles, and their culture is so rich and wonderful. So I love that, and it was great to sort of get the chance to sort of meet the orcs as another kind of homeless, culture looking for somewhere. And we did a lot of work, you know, Bayona in the first two episodes was, talking about the battlegrounds that the Harfoots might have camped on, you know, with this nomadic life. Or so all these cultures sort of caught bits of each other, you know, like the Harfoots had jewelry made up of old arrowheads and things like that. And, you know, we found little things that you might not have focused on. I mean, we spent 8 weeks building giant blackberries and stuff like that for the
sure.
world. But, you know, it's you know, just trying to add sort of things that work for the way the culture works. And every culture has a different, as we know now, that sort of understanding and respecting that and sort of, you know, finding different languages. There was a colour palette for each culture that we built and developed. You know, sets of rules that, you know, were there with Tolkien's stuff and then his work, and, you know, just what we needed to sort of shape the show. So there's a lot.
I've got a question for you. Do orcs have a fashion sense? And I mean this sincerely. Like do orcs know how to wear armor properly, or do they even have a sense of how they dress or not?
Well, these poor darlings, they've been underground for a long time. They were driven underground. So, and we as a department, we were sort of looking at that, and you know, there's all those beautiful tales of the worms, you know, underground, you know, what we call dragons without the wings at that point. And, you know, the idea of shedding skin, and we were going, well, what would they be wearing in their coloured milkiness, and sort of using, you know, they were sort of not scavengers such, but they've always been a bit like that, you know, whether it's, you know, in Lord of the Rings in the trilogy, it was, you know, lots of body parts and things taken from there. So the language keeps going. And I sort of saw them, this lot is almost sort of fallen angels at one point, you know, we're sort of to the creation of them. So that was part, you know, that and the pallidness of being underground and using the worm skin sort of created you know, there were some images there. We, as we came into the nightmare and the sort of looking at through Aaron Deer's eyes and that, we were sort of, you know, creating these sun hoods and helms to sort of protect them from that. But it kind of created a sort of Boschian nightmare at points. And, you know, we even had wings ripped off a baby giant eagle because we couldn't make them big enough to create it. But, you know, we had helms from first stage battles and things like that that were, you know, taken. So it's sort of, you know, finding, we made up lots of little stories within our department, you know, because of course I had people like Matt and Daniel, so we'd all be sitting there, you know, creating stuff. And you know, I had, a wonderful woman called Alex working with me, and we all became huge researchers, you know, huge researchers, and we had giant boards everywhere and, you know, texts and things like that. So we had rooms with, you know, tables set up with here's the materiality, and we had always had Tolkien's words above us as a reminder and an inspiration constantly. And everyone in my department read the script, and we had an amazing crew. I think that's one of the things that made the project exceptional for me, was the crew that I worked with and the skill and talent. And, you know, they gave up a significant amount of time, we all did, and their craftsmanship and the energy and just the wonderful camaraderie, and that was a really amazing thing. And I'll be forever grateful to have the opportunity to work with that team.
It was very interesting to watch this episode 6 because you had this clash of cultures, the orcs fighting against the Numenoreans, fighting against the refugees from the countryside. It was pretty spectacular to watch. So it was great to see you. Oh, you're gonna love it. It was by far the best episode. It was really terrific. Well, listen, I know that you're in a very different time zone, but I would love to ask you. You know, a lot of people, we always ask the designers, what advice could you give? You know, now that we've got social media, you've got TikTok, you've got Instagram, people are putting up their work all over the place. What advice could you offer to people that might want to get into this profession?
You mean like don't post lots of shit?
No, I mean, but you know, it's in terms of more than ever, you can get your work out there and be seen.
I think it's such a, every project's so different. And I suppose what's always kept me going is the belief that I treat each project, no matter what it is or what the outcome is or any of those things, I go into it with full commitment and love, you know, and then you've got to hold on to that, you know, remember you fell in love with this project when it gets hard, you know. And I think advice for people wanting to get into it, you start creating it, you know, is all I just got stuck in, you know, but I did have the opportunity of someone once saying to me, you know, you can do this as a real job. And it never occurred to me, because back then people didn't do that as a real job. You know, you did other things, you know, office jobs. And I think, you know, there's so much now with TikTok and all the media they have, there's so much more opportunity to create your own. And that's something I've always gone, oh, in my downtime, I really want to create something, because, you know, there's the work you do for other people and there's the work that you want to do yourself as an artist. And I think anyone wanting to get into it should find similar people and just start doing it. And I've met some extraordinary people through that who are doing something because you've got a similar passion and things like that, and go, oh, you're interested in that too. And it's building those things. And I think that's, you know, it's, I've never been very good at politics, you know, so I haven't got any advice in that respect, but you've got to be, if you want to get into it, you know, I've always treated it as a passion project. That's my personal thing. And in pursuit of, you know, you make mistakes and there's things that you do and you go, I wish I hadn't done that, or it's a learning thing and nothing's ever perfect. And even things that you can be really proud of, you're still in the pursuit of something more. It's a process that will never end. You know, you're never going to have a happy ending. So it's sort of an ongoing experience. And but that's the exciting thing as well. You know, you go, oh, you know, here's the next one. What can we discover from this? And I think you do meet amazing people. And I think, I think there's no rules anymore in that way. You know, people, even colleagues of mine that have come into the industry as costume designers, a lot of us approached it in different ways or fell into it in different ways. You know, it's not always about going to a school to learn a specific thing in this industry. And it certainly wasn't for my generation. We didn't have schools, but you can learn something in a structure and then take it out there and then learn that everybody works differently. You know, there's a whole lot of other things to learn about working with people, you know, and so that's a whole part of the job as well, not just what you create. It's about how you work with people in those relationships and that. But it's exciting. It's never boring.
Right.
It's never boring.
Are you on social media?
Ooh, yeah, I have an Instagram, but I don't use, I kind of have moments of going, I have an Instagram and all of that, but I sort of have moments where I don't post anything for a while. I don't have a very, you know, I haven't found the voice for that yet. So it's sort of, I always, oh, I don't really feel like posting stuff about myself, but I love being on there to meet other people. And I love, you know, we discover connections, we meet jewelers, we meet all sorts of people just curious about what we do, and we're curious about what they, you know, I love that kind of interaction.
Sure.
And you can spend too much time doing that. You know, there's many times I have to remember to go and read a book, you know, instead of being, you know, glued to my phone. You know, it's become a sort of, so, you know, I'll learn to grow up one day. My daughter sometimes goes, Mum, that's not how you tag someone. She's very unforgiving, but she's been amazing as well.
Now, can you talk about your upcoming project or say what it is?
I'm not sure. Am I?
I don't know.
Yeah. Is it an IMDb? If it's an IMDb.
It is on IMDb.
Yeah. You so, can say it.
Okay, then I have to me. Say, yes, I will say it. Okay, according to the IMDb, Kate, your next project is the Dune television series, the Dune, the Sisterhood, which of course is about the Bene Gesserit, who basically...
It'll be dark then, won't it?
And those are the people that, of course, through their manipulation of bloodlines, they're trying to make the Kwisatz Haderach, or however you pronounce it, the super being that we all know that everyone thinks that Paul Atreides is that, or is he? That's to be seen, remains to be seen. If you're a Dune fan, you already know. But so you're working on that, which is very, very exciting. And again, you're in a world that has a lot of lore and a lot of literature behind it.
It's not very science fiction, is it, really?
Well, it's, I mean, it's in a way, I mean, it. What was it like going from one series like Lord of the Rings into the future without, I mean, you don't have to get into it much, but was it enjoyable then to just delve into more literature to create another?
I've always loved that world. And, you know, of course, there's all the books. So it was exactly the same process, interestingly. You know, this whole... laws and you know, you can't ignore it. And again, like in Tolkien, you have to know what is before and what is after. So the research absolutely is a similar process.
Yeah. Right, right. And then, of course, you have the designs that are in Denis Villeneuve's movies. And the peak verisimilitude, I think Dune, his first Dune Part 1 was one of the most impeccably designed. It's unbelievable. I mean, just unbelievable. Now, you mentioned that you were a big fan of Lynch's Dune when Bob Ringwood and all that. Some of the greatest costumes ever made for a science fiction movie are in Lynch's Dune.
Yeah.
Did you go back and watch that? Did you go back
and watch all of them? I watched Jodorowsky's interview too, and the discussion of his books. You know,
wow.
I did all of it. You know, and looked at illustrations. There's a beautiful Polish illustrator that illustrated Dune, and it's amazing. The language is amazing. The similarities, and the, you know, there's a lot that's inferred, but actually it's very clear. And it's lovely seeing the similar, just as an observer of those two movies, because I'm not talking about my project, but
right.
But looking at them, there's you know, some things that are, you see where the canon is, and you know, thematic things, you know, and there's lovely homages in Denis' one, you know, as well as fascinating how different an interpretation of a scene can be. And, you know, you learn wonderful things from both. I mean, I think, you know, I think there was great, for me at, oh, I can't even remember how old I was, so I'm not even going to try, but, you know, seeing, I'd never seen science fiction like that. You know, when we had Alien come out, we had, you know, Brazil and all of those films and Blade Runner, and it was like there's this whole thing where science fiction suddenly became interesting for me. It wasn't, now no disrespect to Star Trek fans, but it wasn't just Star Trek or Buck Rogers, or, you know, it wasn't a shiny thing. It was more close to fantasy and world building, and that's what I love about this, this, you know, this sort of work is that you get to be in a place that could be real. And I do think, you know, there's a beautiful tone of haunting melancholy in the work. And I think that's what appeals to me, as does Tolkien's work.
Mm.
The two similar things.
Well, Kate Holly, it has been, I know it's midnight your time, it has been such a wonderful experience talking with you today.
Thank you.
I'm a huge fan, and I can't wait to see what you, well, I can't wait to see what happens in, of course, Rings of Power, because we have two more episodes to go, and now that Mordor is with us, and who knows what's going to happen. And then, of course, what you're working on now, the Sisterhood, I can't tell you how excited I am for that. So it has been so great to speak with you today, and I very much appreciate your time.
Oh, well, thank you very much. You've been lovely. Thank you.
And thanks very much to our sponsor for this episode of the Designing Hollywood Show, the Costume Rentals Corporation. The variety of costumes at Costumes Rentals Corporation is expansive. CRC is recognized worldwide as the premier supplier of military and police costumes and uniform rentals. Costumes Rentals Corporation takes pride in its commitment to each customer, helping to produce the type of exceptional look needed for a successful production. A special thank you to founder and executive producer Martika Ibarra, co-founder, costume designer, the legendary Marilyn Vance, and of course, John Campia from The John Campia Show. Thank you to all of our viewers for tuning in, and be sure to subscribe to our YouTube channel. Tune in to the audio version wherever you listen to podcasts. I am, of course, your host, Robert Meyer Burnett, and you can find me on Instagram at RM Burnett, or find me on Twitter at Burnett RM, or on YouTube at Post Geek Singularity. Thanks very much. Like, subscribe, and give us your comments. What would you like to see on the channel? Right down below. Thanks very much for watching, and we'll see you on the next episode of Designing Hollywood.